Three things that children need to grow up to become healthy adults. I'm here without my wife today, Corrine. She is, who I've been married to for 35 years. She is in Charlotte this morning with family members. It's my nephew's one-year-old birthday extravaganza. I feel sorry for him because he is setting the bar so high. If he ever has another child, I don't know how he will manage it. My wife and my children and my nephews and nieces are quite amused that I, of all people, am talking about how to raise children in the digital age. They're constantly giving me lessons on how to use my iPhone and my iPad. I'm probably a disgrace to my iPad because it sits on the table probably about 90% of the time and is, you know, compared to what you all do. I mean, it's hardly ever used, but I've got it, and I know how to turn it on, and I even get on the web with it. So I'm learning. So I'm figuring out this digital age. A few weeks back, somebody in my Sunday school class made an announcement about this seminar, and he posed the question, I wonder if it's any more difficult to raise children in a digital age than in an analog age. And I thought, well, that's an interesting question, since I grew up in an analog age. And so I think for the most part, it's really not. That technology does present ourselves as parents with some very unique challenges that and issues that we need to address. But really what is needed is what has always been needed. And that's a reasoned, balanced, and biblically informed approach to parenting. That's what children have always needed, and that's still what they need from us as parents. A major problem in parenting that I see these days is that we become too child-centered. Our children, if you think about it, they're safer. They have more opportunities and more options than ever before. Yet parental anxiety is worse than ever. We're worried and focused on our children way more than we have been in generations past. In our contemporary culture, the future, the happiness, the success of our children is a paramount concern over many others. And so technology is one thing that has to be sort of factored into the grid of how do I raise my kid and not mess them up, not do something that's going to negatively impact them. I've been reading this book called Crazy Busy by Kevin DeYoung. He is a pastor of University Reformed Church in East Lansing, Michigan. It's insightful for a lot of reasons, but he's got this chapter in there on parenting that it was just so relevant that I just have to tell you some about it this morning. And he says that part of our problem with busyness, he says, is the issue of kindergarten. Kindergarten is a term that was coined by an author named Joseph Epstein, and he says he defines kindergarten as all arrangements are centered on children, their schooling, their lessons, their predilections, their care and feeding, and general high maintenance. Children are the name of the game. Families today are structured around their children like never before. And I think compounding this is the myth of the perfect parent. I like to say myth of the perfect parent because it sort of just brings some reassurance to my own soul. I have five children. They range now in ages from 30 to 20. Two of them are adopted. And it's a good thing they're not here because they'd be glad to tell you about the mistakes I've made. But in a child-focused culture, there's this heightened focus on parents doing it right. And it's given birth to this idea that really, in order for kids to grow up and be successful, they need perfect or nearly perfect parents. And I see this as prevalent in the church as it is in secular culture. So let me read a few sentences here from the Young's book that I think sort of set the stage for what I want to say. He says, parenting has become more complicated than it needs to be. It used to be, as far as I can tell, that Christian parents basically tried to feed their kids, clothe them, teach them about Jesus, and keep them away from explosives. Now our kids have to sleep on their backs. No, wait, their tummies. No, never mind, their backs. While listening to baby Mozart and surrounded by scenes of Starry, Starry Night. They have to be in piano lessons before they are five and can't leave the car seat until they're about 5'6". It's all so involved. There are so many rules and expectations. Parenting may be the last bastion of legalism, not just in the church, but in our culture. Where is this idea that kids need perfect parents come from? It's really nowhere in Scripture that I can find. In fact, when I think about what Scripture calls me to as a parent, the focus is not on the outcome. The focus is on what do I do? How do I live? How do I talk to my children? DeYoung goes on in this book to cite some recent research that really sort of backs up this idea that kids don't need perfect parents. And they use twin and adoption studies to really demonstrate that in most areas, except for a few, and I'll tell you what those are in a minute, but in most areas, nature is more important than nurture. In other words, it's what's inside the kid when he's born, genetics, and his God-given gifts and abilities and talents that have more to do with his success, his happiness, how he does in school, how he connects with other people. It has more to do with it than what we do as parents. Now, that may fly in the face of some common wisdom, but let me just read a couple things to you here that will help us understand that. In a book, Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, written by Brian Kaplan, professor of economics at George Mason University, his thesis is, parents make their work more difficult than it has to be because they overestimate how much depends on them for the future well-being of their children. He cites numerous twin and adoption studies which conclude that with almost every desirable trait parents wish to pass on to their children, from health to happiness to intelligence to success to general affability, nature is more important than nurture. His contention, though, is that within the framework of pretty normal families, which is what I'd like to think most of us are, in the developed world, different approaches to parenting do little to determine the kind of adult a child will become. Interesting, Kaplan mentions three traits that are more susceptible to parental influence than others. And these are, the first two of these are religion and politics. And so the research is bearing out that really what is most important for us to focus on is training our child in a biblical way. As Proverbs 22:6 will tell us, training a child in the way he will go. Which again is more than just teaching Scripture. But it really just sort of bears out the idea that as parents, our predominant focus needs to be in teaching our children how to be Christians, how to live biblically in this world that they're in. I'm just going to touch on one thing here and come back to it later, but this gets to the idea of recognizing as a parent, what am I responsible to versus what am I responsible for? And I have a lot of responsibilities to my children, but I'm not responsible for what they decide. I'm not responsible for their sin nature. I'm not responsible in most ways for the outcome of the parenting. In other words, what kind of adult my child becomes. So again, this maybe is just to assuage my own guilt, but it's long been my position that children just need good enough parents. If my wife were here and if she told you her story, which is not a secret, she grew up in a very dysfunctional home. She didn't have good enough parents. And in spite of all that, God has done an amazing work in her life. And so even in spite of mistakes that parents can make, God can still bring about his purposes in our children. But think about what happens for a moment when you hear people talking about somebody's child who's got problems. Maybe it's teen pregnancy. Maybe it's an addiction. Maybe their child is in jail. What is the first thought that you have if you're honest with yourself? I wonder what those parents did to mess that kid up. Okay, and that's really not fair because in one sense, we miss completely the idea of a sin nature. And so sometimes we are expecting way too much out of parents and making it way too complicated. And so what I would like to do and focus on this morning are three things that children need from parents. Now, these are broad concepts. They're not going to be surefire techniques to raise the next Einstein or the next pastor, but they're broad concepts, guiding principles for parents, and they are these. The first is a healthy spirituality. The second is a healthy sense of self. And the third is healthy parents. And so I'm going to take a little bit of time to go into these three in a little more detail. So the first of these, healthy spirituality. Now, spirituality is a term that the culture has robbed from Christianity. But spirituality, healthy spirituality, first and foremost, is biblical. It's sourced in a biblical theology, but it's way more than theological understanding. For sure, a healthy spirituality, you know, is exemplified in a biblical worldview. But healthy spirituality is also relational. We're relational beings. We have a relationship with God, as well as relationships with others. And so a healthy spirituality is experienced in relationship. And so let me take this another step further. Is my relationship with God based on grace or law? Now, we, of course, know the right answer. We're Reformed evangelical Christians. We know that my relationship with God has nothing to do with what I did. It's all based in grace. And in spite of my sin, he's chosen to love me and redeem me. But yet I see many in the church, as well as in our contemporary culture, who are bound up in a works, sort of law-oriented kind of faith. So just consider these questions for a moment. In terms of your relationship with God, is there anything you can do to make God love you more? Is there anything you can do to make God love you less? When I'm in obedience, when I am following God's will, does he love me more than when I wasn't, than when I'm not? And when I do sin, how does God respond to me? Does he cross his arms, step back and say, are you ever going to get it right? Or does he draw near to me? Does he pursue me? Does he pull me back towards him? Does he look at me in disappointment, disgust, and impatience, wondering if I'm ever going to get it? You see, if I'm saved by grace, then there's another question we have to ask. Why should I follow God's law? And there's important answers to that, but sometimes I think we give our children the wrong answer to that. So the Bible clearly does teach that I'm saved by grace, I'm permanently and completely loved by God, nothing I can do will change that. But many of us struggle not only to believe that and to live that out, but to have that become a part of our parenting. And it's vitally important that we get this right and exemplify this. So how does this truth play itself out? When did God love me? Romans 5:8 tells me he loved me when I was his enemy. When I was running as far and as fast away from him as I could, that's when Jesus chose to die for me, in the midst of my sin. That decision for him to pay the penalty for my sin was made before I was ever created. And so I already have all the love that I'm going to get from God. And it's not a begrudging love. It was his pleasure to do that. Think for a moment about how active God is in making me lovable. Ephesians 5:26-27 says that Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. So this is how Christ loves the church, his bride. The imagery here is amazing if you think about it. He takes a homely, unkempt, unsophisticated woman, sends her to a salon and a hairdresser and charm school, and when she's as beautiful as she can be, he presents her to himself as his bride. God is actively involved in making me the kind of thing that he would want to love. It's not up to me to do that on my own. Certainly, I participate in my sanctification process. But he loves me enough to be actively involved in that process. He sees the beauty in me and spends my entire Christian life trying to beautify me until someday he presents me to himself and completely glorified. So, does this make obeying the law irrelevant? Not at all. All it means is that my behavior is not going to earn me more of God's love. But my behavior is very important, and for a different reason. And the given reason here, obviously, is that, you know, God is righteous and he is holy, and that's what he wants to make happen in us. And that's what we needed to be in his presence. Christ paid that and resolved that for me. But there's an even deeper reason. You see, my sin doesn't change God, and it doesn't change the efficacy of his work. It changes me. My sin places something between me and God, shame and guilt. It distracts me. It keeps me from living how he's called me to live. It gets my focus off. Sin damages my own thoughts and my emotions and my beliefs and my relationships. And it creates negative consequences in me that I will have to live with the rest of my life. So God hates my sin because of what it does to me and what it does to my relationship with him. He wants so much more for me than to settle for that. So it's so important that we help our kids to get this. Okay, so that's the book of Christianity 101. You all get that. So how does this play out then in my parenting? How does this come out when I'm wanting to work on something with my kids? So think about internet usage. And I'm going to talk to my son about his use of the internet. Jack has clearly laid out for us the dangers of internet pornography, and I'm not going to repeat his talk. But it is an issue that I think as parents, if we are going to give our kids this technology, and by the way, I don't wear a watch anymore because this tells me what time it is if I push the button. But if we're going to give our kids these things without any instruction, I might as well hand them a loaded gun and say, have fun. Okay, and so, but how do I talk about that? How does biblical Christianity influence how I'm going to talk to my child about the use of these devices? So I say to my son, you know, you don't want to use pornography. I mean, you don't want to use the internet to look at pornography. You need to be careful where you go on Facebook, because with just a couple of clicks, you can click on all kinds of pictures where you'll see women partially or completely undressed. You need to be careful what apps download on your iPhone or your iPad, because some of these apps are really just hookup sites. Or some things like Instagram are going to show you things that you really don't want to see. So don't use your social media in any way that you're going to find or come across women who are partially or completely undressed. And he says, sure, Dad, I get that, I understand. At the very same time, his God-given male sexuality that has eyes that are drawn to look at females, his hormones, and his peers are all telling him the opposite. Look at this stuff. Check this out. This is good. So how am I communicating about this in terms of his relationship with God? That if you do this, God's going to be disappointed in you. He's going to be angry at you. He's going to push you away. He's going to be disgusted with you. Or do I help him see that God has something better for him? That God and I love him so much that I don't want him caught up. We don't want him caught up in this insatiable thirst for something that will never be satisfied. And that he will get in bondage and have to go over and over. That after he looks at such images, he's going to feel such an intense shame and guilt, and yet he'll feel like he can't control himself. Do I help him to understand that, you know, what God really wants is for you not to get an incorrect or unhealthy view of women or of the marriage sexual relationship? Do I help him get and understand the teaching of Psalm 103 that God has compassion on you? Son, he understands what you're made of. He knows your struggle. And by the way, he also, when you're tempted, provides you a way out. 10:13. And then do I sit down and talk with him about what are some of those ways out? You know, that's a wonderful verse. We talk about 10:13. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And when you are tempted in such a way, God provides a way out. Great. What's that way out? No one ever told me that. You know, I had to figure that out on my own. And so am I going to help my son figure out what are the ways out that you have? The truth is that in a lot of ways, I'm drawn way more to love and grace than I am to condemnation. And if I can grasp how much God truly loves me, then there's a greater chance that I'll desire him and pursue a relationship with him. I know there's a sin nature in me that I'm at war with, but I think I have a better chance of helping my children live in a godly way if I can help them understand just how much God loves them. So in healthy spirituality, then, I help my child to see this balance between being loved unconditionally, saved by grace, and yet learning to follow what God has laid out for me as his plan. Because it's what benefits me and my life and my relationship with him. When Jesus said in John 10:10, the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy, but I've come that you might have life abundantly, Jesus was talking about way more than just salvation. He was talking about he's coming so that we can have the life that God intended us to have, not be weighed down and defiled by sin. You know, children don't want to hear from us, do this because I've always done it this way, do this because this is what Christians do, do this because these are the rules, do this to avoid punishment, do this to avoid disapproval. Do what I say, not what I do. Did any of you ever hear that from your parent? Do what I say, not what I do. No. They want to hear, do this because this is what's best for you. This is what's going to give you life. They really do want to hear, you know, son, if you can delay gratification, what you will experience down the road will be way better for you than what you experience now, that immediate pleasure. Do they believe you? Not necessarily, but that's what they want to hear. So a healthy spirituality is the first thing that kids need to grow up to be healthy adults. The second thing they need is a healthy sense of self. Now, you did invite the psychologist, so I do get to use some psychological terms with you, and I will try and explain those as we go. And so now my other piece of technology, this pager for the Counseling Center, that I've been wearing for the last 2 weeks has never gone off in the past 2 weeks until I'm right here. So I'll have to answer that in a minute. So healthy sense of self. What is a sense of self? It's one's identity. It's our individuality. It's our personhood. It's our basic psychological structure. Or maybe another way to think about it is it's our psychological maturity. It'd be helpful for us to think for a moment about psychological development. We know that each of us are uniquely and intimately created by God, and we are born as infants and have to grow up into the person that he's created us to be. Much of our individuality is created by God and is neither right or wrong. Things like our skills, our interests, our talents, our personality traits, and part of growing up is figuring out, who am I? Who did God make me to be? And then there's aspects of our psychological functioning that can be healthy or unhealthy. And when they're healthy, things just tend to go better in life. And so I would like to briefly outline for you four aspects of a healthy sense of self, of a mature psychological functioning. And I think I'm going to try and make the case that although these things are not necessarily taught explicitly in Scripture in a particular verse, that these are clearly seen when we look at what the Bible teaches, clearly even seen in the life and ministry of Jesus. Okay, so the first aspect of a healthy sense of self is the individuality and togetherness forces. Now, this is not like the force be with you, but force is a metaphor for like a drive or a tendency. And if you think about a continuum, sorry about that, I thought I had that. I just have to leave it. I'm not sure how to turn it off. If we think about a continuum with togetherness over here and individuality over here, there's a place in here that we want to be. And so togetherness is about attachment. We were created to attach. A baby is all about attachment. In fact, a baby isn't capable of any kind of independent functioning. If it is not attached to its parent, it can die. But the goal of parenting is to raise this completely dependent baby into an independent functioning adult. In togetherness, what affects one affects all. So in a family with high degrees of togetherness, there's pressure for all of us to think and feel and act the same. Differences will begin to cause some stress or some tension, and too much difference will result in pressure to be more like the unit. Consider for a moment politics in a family. You know, if you're sitting around the dinner table at a family gathering, people can tolerate a little bit of independent political thinking. But if you start diverging a little bit from the norm, what happens? People start to get agitated. People start to address you. They try and even maybe change your opinion. Too much togetherness requires we all think and be and act the same. Or how about the adolescent peer group? What happens to the adolescent peer group? Well, it's quite all right to be different from everyone else as long as we're all different in the same way. But if you try and be different from the way we're different, then that's not acceptable. So individuality is about figuring out, who am I? What are my skills? What are my abilities? What are my beliefs? What are my interests? What are my goals? And being the best person that I can be, regardless of what others think. Individuality pushes us to be our own person and yet stay in relational contact with others. Just hang with me. If a person, though, has too much individuality on this continuum, they become selfish and they don't really care about other people and how their actions affect other people. At the same time, there's a certain amount of individuality that's needed, and it's healthy and it's necessary. It enables us to take a stand on principles and beliefs and to hold that stand regardless of the pressure that we encounter from others. So think about what happens in a group. There's a teen and he's in his peer group and they start telling crude jokes. They talk about wanting to cut a class. They talk about using some alcohol or marijuana. If he begins to resist that and oppose that, he experiences pressure and ridicule. Think about your experience as a Christian adult. And you're standing around after church, and people begin to talk about someone else. I mean, share concerns about someone else. And you object based on the ground that, you know, this is gossip. There's some pressure there. There's some relational tension to not stir things up. So it's that force of togetherness, that desire to be accepted, to belong, to be part of the group, to not be thought negatively of, that will compromise our principled living. Living by principle requires a person to endure a certain amount of anxiety in relationship, the risk of being different and not thought well of by others. And so, with togetherness here and individuality here, we're after some kind of balance. If the balance is more towards togetherness, one's less able to think for themselves, more tied into what others think, and differences will create anxiety and tension in the relationship. But if people are balanced a little bit more towards individuality, they're able to think for themselves independent of relationship pressures. They can be cooperative, but that the actions they choose are based out of principle. So most people are more weighted towards togetherness. What people think about us really does matter. In fact, if we're honest with ourselves, sometimes what people think about me matters too much. And my struggle is, can I choose a principled way of life and not let what people think of me matter too much? So let's consider Jesus here as an example. I just picked a passage the other day. I was looking at Matthew chapter 19 and 20. So the rich young ruler comes to talk to Jesus. He's the rich young ruler. And so he's obviously accomplished a lot. He's got some position in society. He's probably pretty well connected. He's the kind of guy who can maybe make things happen. And so I can imagine the disciples thinking, oh no, Jesus, not this guy. Now don't set him off. Now don't talk to him like you talk to everybody else, because we could really use this guy later, okay? And so the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and pretty confident in how he's lived. And he says, this is all I've done. Look at how I've lived my life. I've followed the law. And Jesus says to the rich young ruler, but you missed the point. That's not enough. And so what happens? The rich young ruler goes away, downcast and discouraged. Jesus was able to respond out of a principled place. He knew what was true, and he responded out of a principled place, regardless of whatever the pressure is, whether someone's going to be displeased with his answer, whether he might not be accepted with what he's saying. Jesus operated out of principle. And so just a couple days later, after they've moved closer towards Jerusalem, oh, by the way, after Jesus has already told his disciples in this intervening period that he's going to have to go to the cross and die, the mother of the sons of Zebedee, James and John's mom, comes and talks to Jesus and says, hey, I got this idea. When you finally get your kingdom, can you put one of my sons on each side of you? Okay? And so once again, there's this relational pressure. Do I disappoint this lady? Do I make her sons, who've been following me, a couple of my biggest supporters, kind of mad at me? Or do I respond out of principle? Now, it's easy to say, well, that was Jesus, and that's what he was supposed to do. But yet you and I are called to principled living. That's what Scripture tells us to do. Not to live based on emotion, not on what's going to keep harmony in the group, but principled living. And so that's an important part of healthy psychological functioning that we want to help our children learn. The second part of this healthy functioning is thoughts and emotions. We were created by God with thoughts, the things we think, and the things we feel. Emotions aren't bad. They're part of our humanity. But how did God create our emotions to work? Well, they're certainly not to be eliminated, to be suppressed, or even to be denigrated. But they're not to rule and guide our behavior either. In a mature, healthy self, thoughts manage emotions. We choose behaviors, we choose a course in life out of rational, objective considerations, not out of emotional ones. It's not that we don't feel deeply, it's just that we don't let feelings drive our behavior. And again, we have a term for that. We call that emotionally reactive. And so in any situation, including my parenting, at any given moment, I might be faced with a choice. Am I going to parent out of principle because I've thought about parenting, I've come to learn about parenting, I've decided how I want to be a parent based on some biblical and objective healthy principles, and am I going to parent out of that, or am I going to parent out of my emotions because I'm angry, I'm worried, I'm frustrated? Now, we all will parent out of emotions from time to time. Okay, so the goal is not to eliminate that. The goal is to minimize that. The goal is to be working on parenting and living out of that principled place, guided by thoughts, not emotionally reactive. And why is that so important for me as a parent? Because if I want my child to get that, if I want my child to learn to relate to his brother or sister, to somebody out in the world, not out of an emotional place, but out of a principal place, I need to teach it, and I need to model it. And so part of healthy psychological functioning is having our thoughts manage our emotions. A third part of the healthy psychological self, I'm going to throw a couple more psychological terms at you now, is the true self and the false self, or the basic self and the pseudo self. So the true self is this sort of mature, this stable part of me that is stable over time. As I said before, it's guided by principles, well thought out principles based on fact, logic, biblical truth. This true self, this basic self, it's not affected by relational stress and anxiety, but it knows where it stands and what it believes. And it remains in relational contact with people even when they're different, even when they're unhappy with me. Now, this false sense of self, it's less mature, it's less stable, and it's the part of you that, you know, on a good day, you look like you got it all together, okay? And then stuff starts happening, and you start getting frustrated, you yell at somebody in traffic. You know, it's that part of you that when stress gets high, your functioning goes down. And so the goal for all of us is to have higher amounts of true self and lower amounts of false self. So how do we get there? Okay, that's the sanctification process. That's the process that we spend our whole lives learning. So it's not like, okay, we help our kids learn this, and then when they're adults, they've got it. No, you and I get to spend our whole lives learning how to grow, how to be mature, how to let our thoughts manage our emotions, how to come up with principles that we're going to live by, how to not let the anxiety and the pressures of life or my relationships with other people compromise me from who I want to be. I get to work on that, and I get to help my children work on that. Okay, and so the last part of a healthy sense of self has to do with boundaries. Now, you know what a boundary is. Boundary says this is where something stops and this is where something else begins. So the boundary between your yard and your neighbor's yard says this is your property and that's his property. And so boundaries in relationships look the same way. A boundary in a relationship says this is what belongs to me, my thoughts, my feelings, my actions, my needs, my desires, my decisions. Those belong to me. They don't belong to you. And yours belong to you, and yours don't belong to me. Healthy boundaries are an important part of psychological maturity. Learning the difference between the things that I'm responsible for and what I'm not responsible for will help me function in a healthy way. Number one, it'll keep me from overfunctioning, trying to manage things in you that you need to manage, like your thinking, like your feelings. You know, it's not my job to manage my child's emotions. That's their job. It's not my job to manage their thoughts. I need to parent in a way that I know is right and appropriate and let them learn to be responsible for managing their own thoughts and feelings and actions and making their own decisions. And so healthy boundaries are about healthy self-management. And so a healthy sense of self has to do with being able to live out of that principal place where thoughts manage emotions, and I've decided how I want to be as an individual, in relationship, how I want to be as a parent, and I learned to live that and model that for my children. So the third thing that children need are healthy parents. Healthy parents have healthy boundaries. They're not helicopter parents. They recognize what belongs to them as parents and what belongs to the child. And what belongs to God? Things like the future, like salvation, like sanctification, like the child himself. You know, just as a quick digression here, have you ever wondered why in Matthew chapter 6, Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, don't worry about tomorrow? Because tomorrow doesn't belong to me. The future belongs to God. What belongs to me is today and what I do with what God has given me today. But when I start trying to manage things that don't belong to me, like the future, I create all kinds of distress in myself, anxiety and worry. And so Jesus says, you just focus on what belongs to you. That is living godly today. Let the Father worry about tomorrow. That belongs to Him. And that to me is just such a great example of how, in boundaries, I learned just to focus on me. And there's so much peace in just trying to manage my life and what belongs to me. That's enough. And there's plenty of things that I get to surrender to God because they don't belong to me after all. Healthy parents have a healthy sense of self, and I've described what that is, and they learn to live that to and with their children. And healthy parents have a healthy spirituality, and we've talked about that. So I wanted to now shift, because after all, this is how to raise your children in a digital age, I think was the name of the seminar. So I thought, well, I should probably leave you with a few principles for technology. So let me just throw these out. This is just my thinking. First of all, technology is a tool that I'm free to use or not use. You know, as image bearers, we're creators in this world, and we create things. And the question is, the things that I create, are they going to be used for good and for God's glory? Or are they going to be used for sin and for evil? And technology is a tool. It's something that can be used or not used. But you have to decide for yourself, and you have to seriously consider, how do I want to use it? With a tool comes responsibility and accountability. My wife and I talk, she's also a counselor, and we talk about, it's just kind of amazing to us, how many people, adult people, don't get, or they don't believe that their spouse has a right to their cell phone, has a right to see their email. I mean, it's like, I've never let her look at my cell phone. Really? You're married to somebody, and your cell phone is private? Your email is private? Your internet usage is private? There's a problem there. You know, with this technology comes accountability, and if I'm accountable to no one with this, that is very dangerous. And so my wife can get on my computer anytime she wants. She can get on my cell phone anytime she wants. And by the way, just so you're not worried, my professional email, she doesn't have access to. Okay. But my personal, everything about my, I know there's a few worried there, but no, our lives are wide open book before each other, okay? And this is especially important when it comes to technology. There should be no hiding that in a marriage. There should be no restrictions around that. And that's what I want to teach my children. You can have technology, but it's not private. I mean, your mom can look at my stuff anytime she wants. And I can look at your stuff anytime I want. That's what comes with technology. Now, that's the deal. If you don't want it, you don't have to have it. But in this home, we don't hide our technologies from each other. It's wide open. We're accountable. Certain technologies are opportunities for your children to learn responsibility, independent thinking, and self-control. And it's like everything else. I mean, back in the day before technology, the big deal was a car. You know, when do they get a car? You know, well, it's hopefully when they're mature enough, but we don't really know if they're mature enough until we actually put them behind the wheel and see what they do with it. And so we make a decision, we think they're mature enough, and then the car is an opportunity to learn more maturity, responsibility, independent thinking. And it's the same with technology. A second point for a principle for technology is seriously consider what boundaries you're going to place around it. When and where will you use it? Now, I don't do this because I use mine as my cell phone as an alarm clock, and I'm not prone to just be on it all the time, but I know some families where after a certain time of night, all the technology goes in one place, in the house, in the family room, and it doesn't get touched until the morning. So you can think about, what kind of boundaries am I going to place around? Where am I going to use it? When am I going to use it? With who am I going to use it? And what will you use it for? What will you do with technology? And what will you not do with it? Again, these are conversations that can happen, that need to happen. And lastly, the third principle for technology use is, don't abandon all old technology. Read a real book. Use a brick and mortar store. Write a letter by pen. And lastly, drive in the car with the radio or the iPod off. Now, my cars are old enough that I can't plug my iPhone or my iPod into the car, but many of you have those cars, and you can plug right in, and you can hear it over the... Try driving without it. So again, technology is about how we manage it, how we use it. The same principles that we want to guide our lives as adults, that we want to guide our parenting, those same principles can guide our use of technology. So in closing, to raise children to become healthy adults, we need to be healthy parents who live and model a healthy spirituality and who have become healthy individuals in our own psychological functioning ourselves. Thank you.